From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, what is Megyn Kelly's future at NBC after her comments about blackface and poor ratings? Does she even have one? Then the designer of a video game about gentrification in Los Angeles, where players try to swallow up buildings, admits that he's, well, part of the problem.
I know I'm complicit in the gentrification of Los Angeles. Like, anywhere I go, because I'm this tech worker, I'm changing the place that I live.
And we continue my conversation with two prominent music critics about the LA Philharmonic Centennial. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's been a week filled with controversy at NBC News. It all started on Tuesday with a segment on Megyn Kelly Today about Halloween costumes.
You do get in trouble if you are a white person who puts on blackface on Halloween, or a black person who puts on whiteface for Halloween. Like, when I was a kid, that was okay as long as you were dressing up as like a character.
Kelly's remarks drew widespread condemnation, and yesterday she apologized on air. But today, there was no new episode of her show, and a repeat was run instead. The former Fox News star came to NBC with a 3-year, $69 million mega deal, but her ratings were never very good, and now it seems it all may be coming to an end. Brian Steinberg has been following the story for Variety. When we spoke, I asked him about the big bet that NBC made on Megyn Kelly a little over a year ago.
I think at the time they saw a viewership that had been energized with Republicans in the White House and Congress, and felt that injecting some of that Fox News attitude into its program could be a valuable thing. You know, at the same time, they also made Greta Van Susteren an anchor over at MSNBC. So there was clearly some attraction with this type of partisan line of programming.
One of the things that I think is interesting is that from the very beginning, Megyn Kelly had a tough time, and there was a confrontational interview with Jane Fonda. How had she done up to this week? How had the ratings been? And how was she perceived both within NBC and by viewers generally?
Well, generally speaking, the show is not pulling in the viewership that it did when Tamron Hall and Al Roker were doing the 9 o'clock hour of today. It's about 400,000 viewers. That is cause for concern, especially when you're up against a syndicated program at ABC with Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest. I think within the network, my understanding is that both sides have grown exasperated, for the word that I got from someone, with each other. I think the show has tried to kind of scramble along and try new formats, test new ideas. Clearly, Megyn Kelly wanted to, I think, break news and explore hot-button issues. And the Today Show, while it does that, it also is a newsy, broad-based program that you know, aims for everybody. And I think sometimes, you know, she got a little too close to bone examining Me Too issues at NBC and things like that that perhaps did not make the executives there overjoyed.
I guess you can make the argument you can take the personality out of Fox News, but maybe you can't take the Fox News out of the personality. Did NBC know what it was getting into? Because Megyn Kelly certainly has a history of making inflammatory comments, not only about race, but also about gender, about sexual assault, about contraception, about Black Lives Matter. There's a whole history there. Did they know what they were doing when they hired her? So should this have been much of a surprise to the network?
I was surprised that they put her into two shows very quickly. I was surprised that they didn't, you know, spend more time having her meet audiences by filing, you know, long reports, filling in for Lester Holt, filling in for Dateline, appearing on the Today Show with reporting. And I was surprised they didn't spend more time developing her storytelling muscle rather than her partisan muscle.
I think there are a lot of people who found her comments about blackface completely indefensible. But among those people were people who worked at NBC and were very prominent on air, including people like Al Roker. How important was it that people on air at NBC said that Megyn Kelly's apology didn't go far enough?
That tells me that dissatisfaction has been brewing for some time, that her fellow colleagues would go on Nightly News and on Today's Show and spend a 5-minute segment discussing this issue and how it wasn't sufficient. That suggests to me that she had not integrated herself that well within the rest of NBC News. And I think she's long, you know, taken pride in kind of having her own persona, cultivating her own swath of popularity, and people followed her for a certain reason. She stood up to Donald Trump. She spoke her mind on Fox News on both sides of the issues, taking on Republicans and Democrats. You know, she doesn't mince words. She doesn't take any from interviewees. That was kind of her brand. And I don't. But at the same time, I'm not sure it blended well with the rest of the people. NBC News is a place of working reporters, not of on-air primetime personalities. Except even at MSNBC, I would argue that Rachel Maddow did a lot of reporting on her own. So I don't know that it gelled right away, and it probably never got a chance to do so.
It feels very much like NBC is scrambling, and I think that's evidenced by what happened this morning, where rather than get a substitute host, they reran a Friday show from the past with Megyn Kelly. In fact, she started the show saying, like, Happy Friday on a Thursday. Is it your sense that the network is really trying to figure out as quickly as possible what it can do with the situation?
Either that or they're trying to tank the show so badly that she can't come back, because airing a repeat during morning news time is death. There's no reason for unoriginal content in that time of the day. People want fresh content. There's news out there. There's commenting on the issues of the day. So I wonder if perhaps they're trying to just sink the show by airing repeats that have no relevance right now.
One of the other issues for NBC is it already has had to dismiss Matt Lauer over what he is alleged to have done in terms of sexual assaults and sexual misconduct. If you take Megyn Kelly with that, and not just the money, but kind of the public embarrassment, where does this leave NBC after all of this is said and done?
Well, it was a big bet to begin with. Morning TV is not an easy place to succeed. Look at Anderson Cooper or Meredith Vieira or Katie Couric have all had daytime and morning shows that last about 2 years or so before going off the air. It is not an easy place. This is a big swing with a lot of money spent on it. I'm not sure. I think they had a big anchor. They didn't have a big idea for the big anchor. And when you don't have both of those elements, it could be a recipe for failure.
Why was this the breaking point? Why was she and the network apparently unable to weather this controversy?
Well, when you get into that kind of topic on broad-based broadcast morning television and you can't kind of control how far you go, I think it suggests a lack of awareness of audience. This is a broad-based morning program. It's not Fox News. It's people who are at home watching, looking for, help, tips, human interest. I think these are topics that a veteran broadcaster would not go into.
Brian Steinberg is the senior TV editor at Variety. Brian, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks a lot, John. Good talking to you.
Coming up, it isn't easy telling a story about gentrification. Making a video game about the subject proved even harder.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Josh Fox with his new work, The Truth Has Changed. From the director of Gasland comes a live performance tracing the arc of American politics from 9/11 to Trump. From his experiences as an eyewitness to 9/11, the BP oil spill, Bernie Sanders campaign, and Standing Rock, Fox delivers an insightful account of how we got to where we are today. October 27th at Brood Playhouse. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Gentrification on the east side of Los Angeles has been a hot topic of conversation for local residents, artists, writers, and activists for some time now, especially in recent years, with neighborhoods like Boyle Heights and Highland Park experiencing an influx of high-end coffee shops, yoga studios, and pricey apartment complexes. The conversation suddenly made it onto an unlikely platform in the form of a video game called Donut County. It was recently released by Annapurna Interactive. Don't be fooled by its obvious cuteness. Even though it's fun to play, Donut County offers a deeper social commentary than the visuals might lead you to believe. When we spoke with the game's designer, Ben Esposito, he explained how it all works.
So you play as a hole in the ground, and you start small and you get bigger. That's the basic concept of it. But beyond that, I was trying to ask or answer the question of, like, why is it a hole? And so the story kind of shaped around this version of LA called Donut County, where you're playing as a new tech gentrifier who moved in. They're a bunch of raccoons who have this app that lets them open up holes to steal people's trash. It's a little bit convoluted, but the idea is that they're kind of displacing everyone in Donut County, stealing their trash, and then putting new raccoonified tech versions of everything down.
So how did Los Angeles and gentrification become part of the design and the look of Donut County?
It started with just the hole, and it took a while to kind of, it took a couple of iterations to land on what I really wanted to talk about. But I think, well, I love Los Angeles, and I moved here in like 2011.
Where were you from?
New York, okay. Originally. So it was a big, big change of pace, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I loved the kind of like, I love the fact that I was familiar with everything in LA, but only through like what felt like a dream, like just seeing movies and seeing media about it. And I wanted to kind of dig into what places and what themes were kind of central to LA. And so the themes of erasure and the themes of like renewal and, you know, the kind of like portrayal of the place, defining the place, is something that I thought would be really cool to you know, mixed with this concept of an ever-growing hole and like a natural disaster and stuff like that.
And I think it's interesting that you live in Highland Park, not far from where we're sitting right now. And Highland Park, in many ways, is the epitome of gentrification in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It is an old neighborhood filled with a lot of old businesses, but on every fifth corner now, there's a cappuccino place. There is like, you know, high-end resale. It is a neighborhood that in real time is gentrifying day by day, hour by hour.
Right, yeah. When I go for a walk in the morning, I always see something new or plans for something new. And I think it took me a while to arrive here, but the approach for Donut County was that like I know I'm complicit in the gentrification of Los Angeles. Like anywhere I go, because I'm this tech worker, I'm changing the place that I live. And so I really wanted the perspective of it to be about like, hey, you are the gentrifier in the case of playing Donut County. Here is some of the impacts and some of the consequences on the community. And also as someone who is not originally from Los Angeles or a neighborhood in Los Angeles, I can only talk about my role in the changes that are happening here. And so it's like I left New York where, you know, Brooklyn was like kind of on the tail end of like the hyper gentrification phase. And so kind of coming here and seeing the same process happen, I was like, oh, man, okay, maybe I'm the problem.
Yes, wherever you go, gentrification follows. We talk on this show with filmmakers who come out of two very distinct camps, the studio camp and the independent camp. And the studios are big behemoth movies that cost $250 million and are tied to brands and franchises. And the smaller independent films are where the stories are really about the story that the filmmaker wants to tell. Is there an equivalent in game design and release? And where would you put yourself on that spectrum?
I would say I'm definitely more established in the indie world, but I am really, really indie in the sense that most of the production of the game was done by myself. And I got some friends to kind of help along the way, like my partner, Geneva Hodgson. She's a brilliant writer and she's a cartoonist. And so she helped me like make the script and edit the story and make the emotional, the beats work. But this project I started on my own in 2012 and it was pretty much just me up until the end.
We're talking with Ben Esposito, the creator of the new game, Donut County. In Hollywood, there's something called development hell, which is like the, you know, the fits and starts that a project has on its path to getting made. And I think it's fair to say that Donut County had its own development hell. You spoke at something called the Failure Workshop in 2015 at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. I'm going to play some audio from your remarks, and then we're going to talk about what it was that you were talking about.
Okay, so here's a disclaimer. I'm not going to talk about design. I'm not going to talk about business. And I'm not an expert on this subject, and that's like why I'm here in the Failure Workshop. And in fact, I'm like kind of embarrassed by what I'm going to talk about. But I think being like an ethical artist is a practice, and it's something you have to be consciously working on all the time. And so I hope I can inspire some folks who are doing the same things and maybe running into the same problems to like examine their work the way I did.
So let's talk about what you're talking about. This game was originally something else called Kachina. Explain what that concept was and what the criticism of it was.
So the game started with a hole in the ground, and the kind of natural thematic extension of that is like it's about erasing things from the playing field. And so I had this idea that I was I was inspired by these Hopi Kachina dolls. I'd always been fascinated by them. I had books about them. So I was like, oh, let me talk about like the erasure of indigenous people in the United States. And let's focus on these interesting characters, like the Kachina dolls. And like, what are their story? Let me do some research about it. And so I was developing the game, you know, with that theme. And the problem with it was just a theme. And the more and more I dug into the actual nature of the Kachina dolls, the more I learned that, like, oh no, this is a religion. And this is a subject that I'm not equipped to talk about. This is a story that is not my personal story. And it did get criticism for that early on. Luckily, like, it was early enough in the process that I could kind of go through the emotional arc of like realizing that this was really the wrong type of story for me to be telling. And so I ended up totally retooling the entire thing. And that's when it switched to being more about my perspective on change in a place.
Your game publisher is Annapurna Interactive, and Annapurna is known as a film company producing and distributing some really good films by some really good filmmakers. I don't think of them as a game designer and publisher. How did you hook up with them, and what are their ambitions for digital content?
They're really interesting. It's been super fun to work with Annapurna because I had known some of the folks who are on the Interactive side from before they were working with Annapurna, and so they kind of had this concept of like, let's take what you're doing for movies and do it for games. And what Annapurna does is they just focus on creators, and they say like, whatever your vision is, like, we will help you achieve that. And it was kind of weird at first because I was like, my game was the first funny game that they were doing. The other games are way more serious and emotional. And I was like, is this okay for me to be doing? Like, does this fit with the brand? And, you know, Nathan from Annapurna Interactive sat me down and he was like, yeah, it's fine. Like, we're here to serve you. Like, let's do whatever you want to do in terms of like, how do you want to tell your story? And that kind of freedom was like scary, but it was also like really empowering. And so it's been a really awesome process working with them.
Annapurna is Megan Ellison's company, and she inherited her fortune from her father, Larry Ellison, who runs Oracle. Larry Ellison is a real life hole in your game. He voraciously swallows up real estate. He owns the entire island of Lanai in Hawaii. He owns an historic village in Japan, reportedly 24 properties in Malibu. Whoa. You're aware of that irony, aren't you?
I'm far enough down on the chain. And I think I don't think that like it has to speak to the hierarchy from which like the money came from at the moment, but I think in the future of games as an art form, I think, you know, that the production of that, I think, will be very important.
I want to hear about this creative community space you have in Culver City. It's called Glitch City, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. What is it?
So it's a independent game co-working space effectively, but it's pretty small in terms of the scope of the people working there, because, you know, the community of indie game developers is small, and we were all working on our own in our garages or in our bedrooms, and it was driving me nuts. And a lot of my friends at the time who were interested in it, we were like, we realized like, wait, if we all put some money together, we can have a place to go to actually do our work and have a real semi-office environment. And so, yeah, we pitched in and we built that in 2013, and it has since become not only like a co-working space, but a hub for indie games and people who are interested in games in LA.
Ben Esposito is the creator of Donut County. Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Coming up, part two of my conversation with music critics Mark Swed and Alex Ross about the LA Philharmonic Centennial. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now the second part of my conversation with two prominent music critics about the LA Philharmonic Centennial season. Mark Swed, who has been with the LA Times since 1996, and Alex Ross, the bi-coastal music critic for The New Yorker, have been following the LA Phil for a very long time. Yesterday, we spoke about the Philharmonic's three pivotal music directors, Zubin Mehta, Esa-Pekka Salonen, and Gustavo Dudamel. But the LA Phil also had two very important general managers who largely shaped the image and direction of the Phil as we know it today. They were Ernest Fleischman from 1969 to 1998 and Deborah Borda from 1999 to 2017. Here's Mark Swed on Fleischman's legacy.
He was a brilliant figure. He was a brilliant promoter. He was able to figure out how to really make Mehta a star and the orchestra prominent and do things that no other orchestra had ever dared to do, take huge political chances, be involved in anti-Vietnam war rallies, all kinds of things. And he had a great, great vision that the orchestra would be more than an orchestra. It would be this kind of community of musicians that was involved in all kinds of ways within the community itself. He was really able to give the LA Phil prominence, but it actually was a very, very good and very important orchestra long before.
Dr. Otto Klemperer, conductor and general musical director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, now addresses you.
In the 30s, it had one of the great conductors of the time, Otto Klemperer. And when you hear old recordings from the 30s and like radio broadcasts in the 40s and that, you can hear that this is an orchestra different than any other orchestra.
How has the LA Phil negotiated its place in Hollywood and its relationship to the movie business, the TV business, and how has that evolved over the years that you both have been watching the orchestra?
Back in the 30s and 40s, the orchestra, in one sense, was completely removed from the growth of symphonic music in motion pictures. And the German emigre composers who came here to write and wound up writing for the pictures, the orchestra had no interest in them. They thought this was sort of schlock, but the young film composers were very interested in the orchestra because the orchestra was playing Schoenberg. It was playing Stravinsky, and they were extremely influenced by that, and they would come to the LA Phil to find out what is going on in music that they could then incorporate in their work.
Alex Fleischman was succeeded by Deborah Borda, who came from the New York Phil, and she's since returned to New York. What was her impact on the LA Phil? What did she bring, and what was her legacy, even though she's only been gone a short period of time now?
Well, she's just a brilliant manager of orchestras, keeping everything in line and handling the budget and so forth. She also has a gift, which I think she shares with Ernest Fleischman, even though you couldn't think of two more different personalities. But I think both of them had this lack of caution and a kind of instinct to go with riskier ideas. And Deborah Borda was very good about promoting female conductors. Mirga Grzinteitila made really some of her first internationally prominent appearances with the LA Phil. Susanna Melki, as principal guest, has done really remarkable things and is very likely to continue doing so this season with her upcoming projects. And I think has really developed a following with the audience. And then female composers, which is a necessity at this point because so many of the dominant names and the most inventive personalities in new music today happen to be women. And, you know, if you are an orchestra that is playing very few or no women, and unfortunately there have been a couple of cases of very major orchestras programming an entire season with no female composers whatsoever, it doesn't necessarily mean you are a misogynist. What it means is you're not playing very much new music.
In 1948, the LA Phil hired Henry Lewis as a double bass player. He's the first African-American musician appointed to a major symphony at that time, and he was only 16 years old. Since then, I think we can agree that the LA Phil has done a pretty good job of representing historically underrepresented voices, either as composers, sometimes as conductors, as musicians. Where do you see that legacy going forward under its new leader, How much can the LA Phil and other orchestras improve? And how much work has already been accomplished by the LA Phil in that realm?
I mean, they're still way behind. Everybody is way behind. But I think it takes time, and there's no organization anywhere now that is developing young talent elsewhere. With the youth orchestra programs that Dudamel has created, there are now four in parts of Los Angeles where you are now building a whole new group of very talented musicians. And, you know, within the next decade or two, orchestras are going to look, at least this orchestra is going to look radically different. And I think the attitude, from what I can gather, and certainly from the new head of the orchestra, Simon Woods, is that you can't do this fast enough.
Last question, kind of a sports question, but not really. LeBron James is now playing with the Lakers. He's a free agent. How many more years will Dudamel be playing with the LA Phil, do you think?
Is a contract through 2022? I seriously doubt that he even knows if he will stay beyond that or not.
Alex Ross is the music critic at The New Yorker. Mark Swed is the music critic at The LA Times. Alex and Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is it for today. Remember to sign up for The Frame's weekly newsletter. It's a great way to keep up with the show. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.